all the Hashimites, and especially when it comes to Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, yeah, they were capable enough to fight the enemy.
Yes.
And that is why the number of the people killed by the Imam or his family members are great numbers.
It's not even in the Rajas, we have that, we can say that if you come one by one, then nobody will, we can say, overcome me.
Yeah, no, and this, that is why finally Umar ibn Sa'd decided to have a kind of a group attack on Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, and that was the tactic through which they were able to martyr Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. And the next point about the number of the people who were killed by the Imam is that the enemy of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam were afraid of the Imam.
Yes.
And the same is true about Abul Fadl Abbas, and in any war. In a war, when a hero comes to the scene, so people are afraid of him. And when he attacks the enemy, the enemy might flee. And through that escape, some people are likely to be killed when they are fleeing.
Yes.
Because we have we are talking about horses, and then some of these people are trampled. So it's been mentioned that some of the people who were killed, it was out of fearing Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. And his greatness and his dignity. And that's when they were fleeing, so they were trampled, and because of that, they were killed. So to just give a summary of what I mentioned, first of all, the number of the wounds are different from one report to another, and we said that it's very natural. It depends on how you want to enumerate the wounds, and all these reports can be true. And
maybe the most tragic scene of all the wars in the history, because when you refer to Maqatil, you know, the martyrdom accounts of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, really some of the details are full of graphic violence. You cannot even mention them on the manaber, or we can't say picture them, for example, in a movie or in a painting or something like that. Really, really harsh. Even you know, just saying them on the words on your tongue will make you, I mean, move your heart.
Yeah, and this is one of the cases, one of the points that make this tragedy unique in the whole history of mankind. So, and regarding this second question, as I mentioned, Imam did not receive all these wounds all at once. It was on a gradual process.
Yes.
So the more injuries the Imam received, he lost his power and his strength.
Okay.
And that was the reason that that finally he was martyred. So we shouldn't think that Imam received 100 wounds and then he continued to fight the enemy as Imam was doing
and this
before.
And this was, the point is that this was a defensive war from the side of Imam, not an attacking war.
Exactly.
Okay, so Imam was defending himself, not attacking. So some people might ask that how an Imam is going to behead this, kill this, and kill that, okay?
Exactly.
So it was a defensive strategy from the side of Imam. And up to the last moment, he wants to guide them through words and wisdom. And this is interesting. I mean, even in the last moments of his life, when Shebrem the Zedjoshan is on the chest of the Imam to behead the Imam,
that's
Imam
the
is
point.
Giving pieces of advice, giving a hadith, I mean, right, guiding him into a right path.
Definitely.
And this is really, really, you know, unbelievable. Okay, that's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh, for your nice elaboration regarding this topic. I mean, the wounds that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam took on the tragedy of Karbala. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Li Aliyin wa Husayn wa Hasan. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين حسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
يوسف جلالي بتهران
روبا شابت غازا
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Mourners in Karachi commemorated the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussain's youngest child who was not spared by the enemy forces.
The 6-month-old Ali Asghar, the youngest son of Imam Hussain, was martyred by the forces of Yazid. The Battle of Karbala and Imam Hussain's sacrifices for righteousness and freedom are still a source of inspiration for Muslims around the world.
Mothers who brought their babies along paid tribute to Ali Asghar on the first Friday of the Islamic month of Muharram and mourned the 6-month-old son of Imam Hussain.
What had the 6-month-old done? We are out on the streets recalling the message of that innocent child of Imam Hussain that we will always stand against the tyrant of the time. We will always stand shoulder to shoulder with the oppressed, no matter what.
Special eulogies and rituals were performed to commemorate the incident where Ali Asghar was killed with an arrow shot in his throat in the plains of the Iraqi city of Karbala.
We are commemorating the martyrdom anniversary of Ali Asghar, the youngest martyr of Karbala, who teaches us the lessons of readiness and sacrifice in the face of injustice and brutality.
Ali Asghar was martyred while he was in the arms of his father Imam Hussain, who was pleading for water to quench the thirst of his little baby. The grandson of Prophet Muhammad and his companions sacrificed their lives but refused to pledge allegiance to the unjust Umayyad Caliph Yazid. Muhammad Turi, Karachi.
Prayers, storytelling and tearful rhythmic chanting are all expected when Shia Muslims begin their annual Muharram commemorations across the globe. Shia Muslims mourn the first 10 days of the Islamic month of Muharram, remembrance of the martyrdom of the Prophet Muhammad's grandson Imam Hussein, who was unjustly slain by an oppressive tyrant some 1,400 years ago.
It isn't only in the East that you witness the mass commemoration of Imam Hussein's legacy, but also a growing community in the West, particularly of Shia Muslim converts, are benefiting tremendously from the story of Imam Hussein.
We spoke to one convert who explained to us why he felt Shia Islam was the ideal faith for him.
That's what I did like about the following of the Ahlul Bayt, because I could see in the condition of black people in the past, we suffered quite a lot. In the past, and when you look at the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, it's there too, that they see people suffering and they didn't like it in their time. And similarly, when we reflect on Hussein and our lives today, we've got to think Hussein didn't like that we mistreated and not respected as a human being. So it's important that we emulate what he stood for.
Despite the growth, some community leaders feel more work is needed to be done to support new converts. Shia Muslims currently make up about 15% of the estimated 3 million Muslims in Britain, with well over 100 mosques across the nation. Ensuring Imam Hussein's memory is being shared like never before. Robert Carter, London.
The United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories says these attacks are illegal and irresponsible. The Israeli regime, however, says they are a preemptive act of self-defense against a Palestinian resistance movement called Islamic Jihad. The occupation forces say the bombardments could last a week, promising more deaths.
As the bodies pile high in the Gaza Strip, emergency protests like this are being held against the Zionist regime's latest onslaught. The pain and anguish is palpable, and with people who have loved ones braving the bombings right now, silence is just not an option.
Two Islamic Jihad commanders have reportedly been killed so far, as have dozens of men, women and children. Palestinians living outside the territories can only pray their loved ones are spared.
Yes, I have three of sisters and I have my mother in Gaza Strip. I'm trying all the time to contact with them, but they told me everything is bad in Gaza Strip. We're just scared. The children is very scared, crying all the time.
They don't know if they will live until, like, you know, night or not. They say, if we respond to your call, then you know we are fine. If we don't respond, you have to be scared and you have to call, like, you know, our relative and see if something happened to us.
The West's handling of the Palestinian crisis, juxtaposed with the support Ukraine is getting, has thrown into stark relief the lack of political will on the part of Western governments to heal this decades-old wound.
The Palestinian problem has been going on for decades, and yet it isn't told about in the main press. Our governments do not support it, neither the Tory party or Keir Starmer or any of them, not even Ed Davey. Then none of them of the Liberal Party support what is going on. Why? Because it's more important to sell arms and to have some sort of democracy, they call it, in the Middle East. But what I think is happening is they're using Israel to create tension in the world.
Leave the Ukrainian with no armament whatsoever, because then if you give a gun to a Palestinian, he's a terrorist. But the Israelis can have all they like. And they are the victims.
The US has thrown its weight behind Israel, as has Britain. Both say Israel has a right to protect itself, but from what? More than 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza have no freedom of movement, sitting ducks for the Israeli occupation forces. In preparation for the attacks, Tel Aviv prevented fuel deliveries to the already impoverished enclave. As a result, hospitals that are only allowed 4 hours of electricity a day will soon be unable to cope. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Voices of grief and sorrow for Imam Hussein, the third Shia Imam, a man who lived 14 centuries ago, but continues to inspire Muslims. Every year during the first 10 days of the Muslim calendar month of Muharram, Iranians get together in large mourning processions to mark the anniversary of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein. He and his 72 companions were killed in 680 AD by the forces of the tyrannical ruler of the time, Yazid ibn Muawiyah, on the plains of the modern-day Iraqi city of Karbala.
After 14 centuries, we continue to love Imam Hussein, not only as our third Imam and the Prophet's grandson, but as the symbol of self-sacrifice and freedom-seeking.
Every year, we participate in the mourning rituals for Imam Hussein to keep his legacy alive. We dress in black, beat on our chests, and shed tears. The blazes of his love never die down in our hearts.
The ninth day of Muharram is called Tasua and is dedicated to Imam Hussein's half-brother, Abul Fazl al-Abbas, who fought alongside the Imam against the army of Yazid. Abul Fazl is highly revered among Muslims as a symbol of loyalty and chivalry.
Abul Fazl holds a special place in our hearts. In the Battle of Karbala, Imam Hussein and his household and their companions were denied access to Euphrates River to drink water, and it was Abul Fazl who fought a large group of the enemy's forces to get to the river, but on the way back, he was brutally killed by the forces of Yazid.
The Karbala tragedy was sparked after Imam Hussein refused to pay allegiance to Yazid, who was known as a corrupt ruler. These people say without the sacrifices of Imam Hussein, Islam as we know it could have been distorted by Yazid.
The reason Imam Hussein rose against Yazid was to tell his community that Yazid was not treading on the path of Islam. And by spilling the blood of Imam Hussein, who was the Prophet's son, Yazid revealed his anti-Muslim stance, and this ultimately led to the decline of his rule.
The climax of the Muharram rituals is the day of Ashura, which falls on the 10th day of the month. That's when large groups of Shia Muslims converge on Imam Hussein's shrine in the city of Karbala in Iraq to pay homage to him.
The event of Karbala is a heart-wrenching story that touches the heart of every listener. But these people say, aside from its tragic side, Imam Hussein's martyrdom is an endless source of lessons about freedom and resistance for all generations. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Scores of people were injured and many more were arrested after government forces attacked Muharram mourners in the Indian-controlled Kashmir's main city, Srinagar. Authorities had placed strict restrictions in the city and sealed the entry points with barbed wires to prevent Shia Muslims from participating in the traditional procession. On Saturday evening, authorities issued a statement upholding a ban on mourning processions in the city center. Police and paramilitary forces were deployed in big numbers to maintain order. Mobile internet services were suspended in parts of Srinagar. However, some mourners defied restrictions and poured onto the streets at many places to mourn the martyrdom of Prophet Muhammad's grandson, Imam Hussein. The government forces swung into action and hit people with canes. A number of mourners were also detained. 3 decades on, the authorities continue to prevent Shia Muslims from holding traditional Muharram procession in the region's city center, citing security reasons. The people here argue if the government can allow Hindu processions and political rallies in the heart of the city, why not Muharram procession?
See, on one hand, we see the whole security mechanism, you know, they get activated when Hindu pilgrimages are granted permissions and security arrangements are being made. But on the other hand, we see when, you know, something related to Muslims is there, they don't grant permissions. We don't want security at the first place. We want permission so that we could carry out our religious activities.
Very recently, ruling BJP party held a political rally in the city center. If authorities can ensure security for that rally, why are our peaceful mourning processions banned? Why this discrimination?
2 major Muharram processions in the city center were banned by authorities following the outbreak of militancy in Kashmir in 1989. The authorities fear the processions could be taken advantage of by separatist groups to stoke anti-India sentiments and hence create security threats. The religious bodies, on the other hand, termed the ban as a brazen attack on their religious freedom.
It is very unfortunate that the authorities are selectively banning religious activities of the majority population here, shutting down mosques and banning processions, even as authorities claim the situation is improving in Kashmir. These days, annual Hindu pilgrimage is underway in Kashmir and all sorts of arrangements are being made to facilitate that. We strongly condemn discriminatory behavior of the government and hope that the good sense will prevail.
The religious bodies have also criticized the authorities for failing to make necessary arrangements, like ensuring availability of essential supplies. They say all promises and claims made by the authorities have fallen flat. Sayyidi Safib, Indian administered Kashmir.
With her trip to Taiwan this week, Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives Nancy Pelosi set off a firestorm in offending China. From the self-governing territory, Pelosi criticized Beijing and its leadership, while carefully outlining the limitations of the U.S. commitment to defend the island.
In the Congress, House and Senate, Democrats and Republicans are committed to the security of Taiwan in order to have Taiwan be able most effectively defend themselves. But it also is about our shared values of democracy and freedom and how Taiwan has been an example to the world in that regard.
China had warned the U.S. and Pelosi against the visit, as it views Taiwan as a breakaway province that will one day rejoin a one China. In response to Pelosi's Taiwan visit, China's People's Liberation Army on Thursday began the largest military exercises targeting Taiwan in decades.
Tension in the situation across the Taiwan Strait is solely caused by the U.S. side. The root cause is Pelosi's selfish and willful interference with Taiwan, which seriously violates the One China principle. The Chinese government has the right to take all necessary and justified actions to firmly safeguard its national sovereignty and territorial integrity.
In South Korea, Pelosi met with the Speaker of the National Assembly. Seoul has been careful to balance its U.S. military alliance and relations with its largest trading partner, China. Pelosi spoke with South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol on the phone, but the two did not meet, an outcome widely viewed as a snub of the third-ranked U.S. official. House Speaker Pelosi later stopped in Japan, where she met with Prime Minister Fumio Kishida. China later Friday announced sanctions against Pelosi and the suspension on several issues of cooperation with the United States. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Britain is on the brink of a recession, as deep as the 90s and as long as the 2008 financial crisis, a bleak projection by the country's central bank. The Bank of England says it's trying to stem skyrocketing prices by raising interest rates by half a point to 1.75%, saying the measure couldn't come soon enough.
If we don't bring inflation back to target, bearing in mind the huge scale of the energy shock we're seeing, if we don't bring it back to target, and if we get these so-called second-round effects entering in, it's going to get worse.
It was news that sent a chill among the public, people already feeling the squeeze on their finances.
Living out on my own and all the bills on, I have to pay it by myself. I'm on minimum wages as a cleaner. And, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do anyway.
The salary is still the same and the prices are going up, far too up. That's the reason. But I have a concern about this.
The Bank of England predicts the economy is going to shrink, with recession starting this year and lasting all the way through the next. That plus the biggest decline in living standards on record and another sharp rise in household energy bills. The bank pins the eye-watering energy price hike largely on rising gas prices owing to the war in Ukraine. But there are other reasons.
It's a whole plethora of reasons coming together. So you can actually look at the effect of the pandemic, what that impacted on manufacturing and consumerability, global trade and supply chains, and the underlying cost of rising commodities, food and other areas. So this is a Gordian knot of elements coming together. Now, untie that knot, and that's what they're going to have trouble doing.
The writing had already been on the wall. Many experts did warn the UK was behind the curve in dealing with rising inflation. Britons are going to see their energy, fuel, and food bills increase significantly over the next year. Charities are warning of a catastrophe this winter. There's talk of creating warm spaces to provide heated sites for those unable to afford their energy bills.
This deluge of bad economic news comes as the country awaits a new prime minister, and that is a month away. But whoever they may be, their job has just become way harder. Cyper is up London.
French President Emmanuel Macron has reached the 100-day mark of his second term, and the contrast with the bold newcomer of 2017 couldn't be more different. Macron is being described as distant, burnt out, weary, and hesitant, but the adjective he may like the least is powerless. 2 months into his new mandate, Macron experienced his worst failure as a politician. His young political party failed to win a parliamentary majority. A president used to ignoring the legislative branch so far hasn't shown much political skill or interest in the tough work of cobbling together successful majorities to get his policies approved. Many believe Macron may call for new elections as early as this year or rule even more often by executive decree. Both options are sure to create major opposition in a new parliament as well as social unrest.
Since the legislative elections, France is in a new political era, dominated by uncertainty. Macron has been acting as if he can easily find a majority in Parliament on a bill-by-bill basis, but I think that has very little chance to work. It's very likely that in less than a year, he'll dissolve Parliament and call for new legislative elections.
Polls show that, unlike most winners of presidential elections, Macron has not benefited from the usual honeymoon or grace period. Just like in 2017, Macron was mainly elected to block the far right, but he's no longer a political unknown without a track record. Instead, he's a polarizing figure who has been tarnished worldwide by his authoritarian repression of the Yellow Vest protest movement, and who is perceived domestically as wanting very different things than the average person. Economic stagnation is already upon the Eurozone, and depression could be next. Political stagnation appears to have taken root in France, with perhaps even a depressed president. 100 days into Macron's second term, it's a summer of silent discontent in France, with possibly explosive autumn unrest looming. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
Gun supporters and expedient politicians who take firearms industry and other military-industrial complex big donor money while expressing heartfelt prayers are disingenuous, disgusting, and deserving of maximum shame, says F. Douglas Stephenson, researcher, in an article published under the heading Gunmaker profits soar as bloody massacres proliferate in the U.S. Stay tuned for more. U.S. citizens are waking up to the fact that so many politicians can be so easily bought by the weapons industry, an industry that doesn't care how many people must die to protect their huge profits. SafeHome.org reports that after a record year in 2020, gun sales in the U.S. dipped slightly in 2021. Still, with nearly 19 million guns sold, 2021 was the second highest year for gun sales in the U.S., behind only 2020, when estimated gun sales topped 21 million. The previous record year was 2016, with about 16 million guns sold. Total estimated gun sales fell 13% between 2020 and 2021, but they remained higher than they were in 2019, up nearly 40%. The large number of weapons in the United States of America is not only highly profitable for the weapons industry, but also further supports the myth that guns are necessary to maintain the image of rugged individualism. The total number of guns sold in 2021 is more than double the number sold in 2001. In fact, sales in the U.S. rose by about 155% between 2002 and 2021. No state had more gun sales in 2021 than Texas, where an estimated 1.6 million firearms were sold in the nation's second largest state. Florida followed closely with 1.4 million firearms sold. DearLord.com reported that weapons makers Roger and Winchester both had profit spikes in recent earnings filings. Their latest 2021 quarters topped record sales the companies had experienced even during the height of 2020 gun sales surge. The numbers come after July 2021 came in as the second best July on record for FBI background checks on gun sales. Roger reported its net sales in the first 6 months of 2021 were up over $130 million or 51% over the same time last year. The company did nearly $200 million in firearm sales alone between April and June. That represents a 54% increase over the same period in 2020, even though the onset of the coronavirus pandemic and rioting drove Americans to gun stores at record rates during that time period. Similarly, Winchester reported the first 6 months of 2021 produced a $412 million or 108% increase in sales. The gun and ammo makers' sales increased even further by 110% when looking at the April to June period. Winchester's parent company, Olin Corporation, saw net income climb from a $120 million loss in the April to June period of 2020 to a $355 million profit in 2021. They went from a $220 million loss in the January to June 2020 period to a $599 million profit in 2021. In spite of the above numbers, many citizens are also realizing that the idea of the Second Amendment guaranteeing the right of individual gun ownership is radical and wrong and was never intended by the founders to be a barrier to establishing a stringent weapon safety and control laws for the U.S. community. Turning gun violence into a mental health problem is incorrect, dangerous, and irresponsible, as anyone with even minimal knowledge of mental health issues knows. It's of course true people who kill children en masse are crazy, but asserting this reality says nothing. All countries have mentally ill and violent people, but U.S. citizens are increasingly more aware that only the United States of America arms them. Although the U.S. public is demanding real changes for much better safety in weapons regulation, the toxic results of U.S. current lack of adequate weapons control policies continues its deadly pace. The United States of America cannot any longer allow the profiteering military-industrial complex and their beholden politicians to get away with hiding or changing the subject, hoping the public forgets about the problem until the next mass shooting. By using denial over many years to reject and avoid the need for stringent gun control legislation, the GOP and some Democrats have fallen into a miasma of self-induced indifference and dangerous permissiveness toward gun ownership and its deadly consequences. The large number of weapons in the U.S. is not only highly profitable for the weapons industry, but also further supports the myth that guns are necessary to maintain the image of rugged individualism. This is why resistance to legislative proposals to better gun control culture and gun violence itself seem to many gun owners as attacks on their own personality and national identity. The bigger, more powerful the weapon, the more powerful the gun owner feels. Many marginalized and enraged lone wolf murderers, thanks to easy access to assault-style weapons, can misuse Second Amendment gun rights to cleanse the world. 21st century U.S. culture still venerates violence with the U.S. myth of heroic frontier psychology, but at the very high cost of crippling and killing American children. Historian Roxanne Dunbar Oritz, in her book Loaded, A Disarming History of Second Amendment, gives alarming statistics about weapons and gun deaths in the United States of America. There are 310 million firearms in the United States, 114 million handguns, 110 million rifles, and 86 million shotguns. The number of military-style assault weapons in private hands, including AR-15 semi-automatic rifles used in the massacres at Majority Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, and at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, is estimated at 1.5 million. The United States has the highest rate of gun ownership in the world, an average of 90 firearms per 100 people. The total gun deaths in the United States of America average around 37,000 a year, with two-thirds of those deaths being suicides, leaving approximately 12,000 homicides, 1,000 of those at the hands of the police. Mass shootings, ones that leave four or more people wounded or dead, now occur in the United States on average at the pace of one or more per day. Disturbing as that fact is, mass shootings currently account for only 2% of gun killings annually. And the number of gun deaths, 37,000, is roughly equal to deaths by vehicle incidents in the United States per year. The Second Amendment, written by James Madison, adopted in 1791, says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Although generations of activists, gun owners, and jurists have disagreed about how this should be interpreted in a modernizing world, what has been recognized is what the Second Amendment was really to be used for. History professor Roxanne Dunbar Oritz documents in Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment, the purpose of armed militias of the Second Amendment. The kind of militias and gun rights of the Second Amendment had long existed in the 13 British colonies and were expected to continue fulfilling two primary roles in the new United States. Number one, destroying native communities in the armed march to possess the continent. And number two, brutally subjecting the enslaved African population. Dunbar Oritz demonstrates that the violence sanctioned by the Second Amendment was a key factor in transforming America into a militaristic business powerhouse. As the fledgling nation embarked on its relentless westward expansion in the 19th century, the labor of powerful, meanwhile, America's gun culture was growing in tandem with the country's increasingly sophisticated publishing and firearms manufacturing industries. Pulp novels romanticized ex-Confederate soldiers and rifle-wielding frontiersmen. Brand name weapons acquired a special status. In the two decades after the Civil War, Dunbar Oritz writes, the Winchester rifle was fetishized for killing Indians, and the cult revival for outlawry. In the process, gun violence and civilian massacres were not just normalized, but commercially glorified, packaged, promoted, and mass marketed. In 21st century America, fantasy and myth about frontier psychology still continue being played out by Hollywood, video internet games, and other manufactured fantasies that promote weapon sales. Just as communities today rely on professional public health experts in epidemiology to control the incidence, distribution, and control of disease in any population, so too for public safety and health, we should rely on experts in weapons control and distribution to advise and design adequate, stringent legislation for community weapons control or regulation. The profile of a gun safety program could include, number one, prior to approving access to any weapon, potential weapon owners should be required to get formal instruction and pass a rigorous background check. Number two, an annual inspection by law enforcement authorities on how ammunition and weapons are stored, plus full inspection of weapons themselves, should be conducted. Number three, banned weapons should be collected by law enforcement as well. And number four, reimbursement, if any, for banned firearms would be the responsibility of the taxpayer and should be considered an investment in public safety. After mass shootings, many have or will use an amateur or banal analysis of the psychology of killers to provide much-needed camouflage for the profiteering military gun industrial complex NRA. Declare that it is a mental health, behavioral health problem, all in the killer's mind, and perhaps we won't notice that. Pathetic U.S. state local non-controlled weapons policy results in amazingly high murder rates, suicides, and frequent mass murders. When deranged people have such remarkably easy access to arsenals of weapons, every so often one of them will go ballistic. We can't eliminate all political, religious extremism or mental illness, but we can most certainly prevent people from having access to rapid-fire semi-automatic weapons and thousands rounds of ammo. The UK has 1/6 Americans murder rate, not because they are psychologically healthier or nicer than the United States of America. The UK and many other countries just don't have or allow the weaponry hardware to be available to do as much damage. Thousands of prayers and thoughts are of little value unless Americans accept the fact that their laws reducing access to weapons need to be greatly strengthened, not loosened. Gun supporters and expedient politicians who take NRA, firearms industry, and other military-industrial complex, big donor money while expressing heartfelt prayers, thoughts, and condolences for dead children, grieving parents, and disrupted communities are disingenuous, disgusting, and deserving of maximum shame for their preposterous and irresponsible scapegoating of the mentally ill, while letting politicians, devotees of loose access laws, and the profiteering gun industry itself continue to squirm out of any responsibility.
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islam my deen.
Islam my deen.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله dear listeners, sisters and brothers from all around the world. Welcome to Youth Station. This is Arab English Radio. I am Asma at your service. And here with me, I have my very special friend.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Zainab. I hope all you're doing good.
So, dear listeners, today we're going to talk about something which is very much of a sorrowful, sad, hard times in life.
Hard times are a part of life.
Hard times are a part of life, but believing that and accepting that is such a very difficult task.
You need
task.
To be a man for that.
Yeah, you have to shoulder the burden. Hard times, the truth that we have to believe in life. What do you think are the biggest truth that we have to accept in life?
Biggest truth? Mm-hmm. That time will not come back.
Yeah.
The time I'm living in right now, it's not going to come back.
Which I can cry over that, because it is very sad. That time would never come back.
Yeah, because Imam Ali al-Islam also puts it that if you are told that you're going to die right now, just to add 5 more minutes to your life, you'll give entire of your whatever you own, every property, everything, whatever you own,
my God.
Just to live for more 5 minutes. So yes, the hardest truth
is that time will go, and it
time
will never
is running,
back.
It will not come back.
Yeah, it will never come back.
That's one of the hard truths.
Yeah.
What about you? What do you feel about the hard
well,
truths?
Well, without thinking, I would say in a heartbeat that it would be death. The hardest truth that we have to believe.
Okay.
I know that whole spiritual thing that we say that there is no death to the spirit, to soul.
Yeah.
But come on, that's difficult to die.
Especially for women.
I guess for every single one, but yes, for women.
Most.
Because we're attached to our body.
Body, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what makes it difficult.
No, not just that, trust me. Because, you know,
the attachment of soul to this body is also something that makes it difficult.
And everything that is unknown is fearful. I guess that's the reason why we're scared of death.
Yeah.
And now if I die, it will be no problem because I'm going into another journey and in the rest, God would help me.
Yeah.
But when it comes to your dear ones, when it comes to the people you have attachment to, it would turn the story upside down. That is where I would say the hardest truth to believe that there are some people in your life that one day they might not be there.
Yeah.
So it is killing.
Of course it is. Of course it is.
Yeah.
Well, to me, another hardest part.
Another hard truth that we have to embrace.
Yeah. I actually recently realized that.
Which?
Which was that you cannot erase from people's brain the negativity they have towards you. The negative thoughts they have about you. You cannot erase that. You cannot replace that with the good things that you want to have in their minds about yourself.
Being an impressionistic person is very sad.
Yes.
You know, sometimes you meet a person and at that very first meeting, you decide about them and that's it.
I actually started working with a person in a kind of, I must say, family. But not a very close relation. However, in this professional work, I was the boss and this family member.
The downer position.
Just last night, the person was telling me, I'm sorry I was not able to do this work on time, but I did it on this time. I was like, it's okay, it happens. And the person was like, you are so kind, boss, towards me. Are you so kind in this and that sense? But the person who actually was a medium between us thinks a very negative of you. And I just stopped there and I was like, please don't explain it to me because it's going to
change my thoughts about him or her.
Yeah, it's going to just, I'm going to feel sick and it's going to be another hard truth that I have to accept.
Yes.
Because that's really hard, you know. I mean, the person comes in as a medium and you provide job for that particular person to another person. And then when you get to know this person thinks sick of you or anyone in any part of your life.
And Zainab, it happens
you realize,
many times in life when you invest in people, but they show you the other way.
They show you their true colors or you get to know about them or, you know, so many different things. But then you actually realize that you cannot change your image in everybody's mind. Just let them think what they think.
Yeah.
This is really one of the hardest truths I had to accept.
Just go for a little break and I'll be back in no time.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Do you believe in perfect partners?
I really don't. I'm sorry to say that on air.
Well, I have to confess that I believe that there are some perfect partners.
I don't think in
but
the current
era. But I
also
have, maybe it's an illusion and one day I'd be disillusioned, but yes, it's unfortunately the truth that we have to embrace, yet I'm working on that, but still I have not came to the point where I believe in that, but we have to believe that there is no such a concept like
hard truth you're talking about is that there are no fairy tales.
That is
not
the
Cinderella.
Point. Yeah.
They're not, there's no Cinderella. There's no prince going to come and find
they
your shoes.
They should have never told us such a story. Then why they created those stories?
Just fantasy to keep you away from the real life so that when you enter real life and encounter the truth, you feel depressed.
You feel disillusioned.
Yeah. So fantasy world has a difference with the real world. It's one of the, again, hard things to admit, accept. Not everything goes the way, not everything has a happy ending like films, the movies.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah. And failures.
Yeah.
Failures are not always bad. They teach you a lot of things, but...
But at the moment, it's very difficult to understand that.
Yes.
When I am in the process of failure, it is very... And somebody comes to me and tells me, okay, don't worry, you're going to learn things from that. I'll punch them. Come on, how can I learn from this?
You will realize with time when you get mature enough.
Yes.
But yeah, that's again one of
when
the
I
hardest
get over
truths
that.
To accept that failures are there.
Yeah,
what I'm trying to say is that not every success comes just as such. One of the hard truths is that failures can be there in life.
Yeah. So Zainab, hardships are part of life.
Yeah,
that
they
is
are.
The hardest truth to believe.
Yeah.
That things that you have in your mind, things that you have predetermined them in your brain are not exactly going to work the same way that you have planned for them.
True.
So you have plenty of obstacles, plenty of twists and round stories that might get into your story and cut all the beautiful fantasized fairy tale stories that you have planned in your brain.
Yes. Well, I think I am. Something is coming to my mind. Is that about?
Oh, that's very nice. You're saving me.
Relatives.
Relatives.
Again, in relations and relatives, you cannot expect everything to be going smooth all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That's another hard truth. That you feel like life is going to be this fantasy all the time. Everything is going to be smooth. Like, I'm fine with my sister right now. I'm fine with my mother right now. I'm fine with my husband right now. But you should not expect that you're going to be fine with every one of them always.
Yes, because your best friends are those who you make most of your fights with them.
Yes, because Imam Ali al-Islam also says that, you know, one of the qualities of a hypocrite is that he's always fine in all situations with everyone. So I'm not saying a believer does
fight. Also, we have another quotation that popped out into my mind right now that says, everyone's friend is no one's friend.
Yes, exactly. That's a quality of a hypocrite.
Yeah.
So you cannot expect that hypocritic behavior in family relations.
So what I conclude, Zainab, is that everything starts from expectations.
Yes, it does.
So in living as a human being, we have to go with the flow, trust in God, find solutions whenever a problem pops out, and then...
accept hardships.
Yes, and live at the very right moment that you're living, at the present.
Yes, yes.
Do not
That's
think too
important.
Much about past, and do not be too much engaged in the future.
And what makes it difficult to accept hard truths, hard truths of life, is being your oversensitive.
Oh, yeah.
Or being hypersensitive towards something.
Oh,
so
yes.
It makes it difficult. So
I
you
can
have
relate.
To act mature.
Yeah.
You have to be mature. You have to admit things, accept things.
This maturity takes so much of time, and it is hard. Like those.
But anyway, they are hardships. Yeah. You have to actually compare yourself with those who are having a much harder time than yours. You don't have to compare yourself with those who are having a better time. We are not recommended to do that. Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, says, don't do that comparison. Even if you want to do comparison, do it with those who are having a hard time than you. So this, another thing, helps you to accept this hard truth of life.
And also we have this concept of sugar-coated pill. You remember when we were kids and they used to give us those pills that were bitter?
Okay.
But they used to help us. They cured us from the sickness that we had.
From the sickness.
So these sugar-coated pills are exactly the same thing with the hardships. They might seem very hard and harsh, and I already told you that at the moment that you are going through those hardships, to believe that something harsh is happening to you is very difficult. But just as Zainab mentioned, through time, as time goes by and as you get mature and as you just evolve into a bigger personality, then you would understand that that hard situation was a blessing, perhaps.
It was a blessing, exactly.
It takes years to understand that, but it exists.
You remind me of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, who says that when you will see the reward of the calamities you had in this life over there, you say, I wish I had scissors and I would cut myself into pieces, getting all those calamities for myself.
And so, Zainab, also there is another point that we should consider. Satisfaction is the source of all the blessings. You know, you should be satisfied with what, with whatever that happens to you.
Actually, you should be thinking that maybe my God wants this right
exactly,
now.
Exactly, yeah. And after all, we have to admit that life is not something, just as we talked about, just it's not a fairy tale. It's not going to end so happily, and you're not going to have all the cheery stuff in your life.
Except the hard truths of life.
Yes, you have to embrace the hardships.
And just
hardships.
In order to go through them, I think we need to educate ourselves more about the worst.
Yeah, that is the point. Educating yourself, trying to ponder upon
that. And how to help yourself go through that time is that going through the verses of Quran, going through the hadith, going through the narrations. I think that's something that's really going to help you to accept those hard truths of life.
And
in fact, deal
believe
with them. It's not just accepting and acknowledging things. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that tough and hard truth is that all solutions are, I swear, in the holy book. I mean, whenever I go through some verse, I really find this is the answer to that particular question.
And in the end, I would say that the only single truth that would never change is that God is always there. So no matter how much hardships you're going through,
He is there.
Just trust in Him. He absolutely is hugging you and walking you through that.
He's closer to you than the juggler vein. He's closer to you than your mother.
Exactly. And He's the kindest Almighty ever. So, dear listeners, this was all the time that we had for today's episode. It was such a nice session, Zainab. I enjoyed
Thank you, Asma.
A lot. And
Same
I hope
here.
The audience had enjoyed that as well. So until another session, I leave you to the never-slipping eyes of Allah. May He protect you and shower you with His blessings. Thank you for listening. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.